I think it's a problem that we have become used to having free digital services, and free in quotation marks, because of course we're then really paying with our private data.
These days, there seems to be a smartphone app for just about everything. One of the more popular categories are apps that track menstrual cycles. More than 100 million women around the world already use them. Some are trying to get pregnant. Others are trying to avoid getting pregnant. And many just want a better handle on what their bodies are doing. But these free apps have trade-offs. Some use sensitive health information to place targeted ads. The apps all need to make money. And that might mean, in a big picture sense, their main product is actually their users' data. Welcome to Prognosis, Bloomberg's podcast about the intersection of health and technology and the unexpected places that it's taking us. I'm your host, Michelle Fay Cortez. For most of us, giving away our data is just the deal we make when we're using a free app. But a growing number of women are saying, no, thank you. And some are taking matters into their own hands. Bloomberg's Naomi Kresge went to meet a group of feminist coders. Our story starts at the Rainbow Factory, a community space in Berlin's hotspot for startups, the Kreuzberg neighborhood.
I'm standing in the cafe at the community space. It's packed, with about 24 people crammed around mismatched schoolroom-style tables and chairs. Someone just popped open a bottle of East German sparkling wine behind the bar, and they're handing it out for free. People are here to celebrate. Everyone stops toasting each other and settles down, turning their attention to a projection screen. Next to that screen is Marie Kochsiek, a 30-year-old sociologist and software developer. She pulls up a slide with a grid of logos for different period tracking apps.
Don't get me wrong, I don't think pink is a bad color. I just think it's not the only one. And I also think flowers or the heart or butterfly or this very cute girl with these big eyes, they don't really represent me. They don't really represent us.
Marie is one-third of the leadership team for Bloody Health, the coding collective that just released the first female-developed open-source menstrual cycle tracker in English. It's called Drip, and this is the launch party.
Now, after all these, no privacy, no security, black box algorithms, gender stereotypes, now this is Drip.
The seeds for the Drip project were sown back in 2014 when Marie got her first smartphone. It was an Android. She was a bit of a late adopter on the smartphone, but she knew what she wanted to download right away.
I looked into the Play Store and I found a period app. And I just took like the first one. Yeah, I think it was Woman Lock, which is also the icon with a pink flower on a black screen. And it was the first app that I've seen. And the very same day, I met with a friend of mine and I was very excited. And I told her, oh my God, I just found this cool period app. It's so useful. I love it.
If you have ever had a period, you know why Marie was so happy at first when she found that app. Periods can turn up at the most annoying times. They can ruin your sheets and your Tinder dates. But period apps promise to do more than just help you keep track of bleeding. The broader pitch is that if you give the app enough details, you can get a heads up on all the other, sometimes frustrating, changes that come with your cycle. Why am I feeling depressed? What the heck is going on with my digestion? Could I be pregnant? The desire to connect the dots between the period and everything else has helped make the apps so popular. They're consistently in the top 10 most downloaded in the App Store. Just about every commercial period app lets you do more than just click a calendar day so you remember when your last one happened. They also make predictions about when your next period will come. They let you track everything from sex and boozy nights out to ovulation tests, vaginal discharge, and resting body temperature. But apps don't necessarily have to meet the privacy standards of, say, doctor or hospital records. In fact, as one of Marie's friends told her, the commercial apps can use your data for plenty of things that do not have anything to do with keeping track of your period.
This person looked at me. She was a very close friend, so she looked at me and said, like, Marie, have you read the privacy policy of this app? And I was a bit annoyed at her because she kind of took away my joy in that moment. But the following day, I deleted the app.
All of that data can be used for the same type of business that Facebook, Instagram, and other major apps use it for. Facebook is already controversial. But here we're talking about even more personal data than what most people share with social media. Joanna Varon, a Brazilian researcher and digital rights activist who leads the group Coding Rights, explains.
So it's a lot of information that is collected, and the information that you get back, it's only when is your period and when is your fertile moment. It doesn't need to ask all those questions to have this outcome as an information, no? So, of course, this is going somewhere else. And then if you go and look at the terms of services, they say we might give it to the data to third parties for advertisement purposes and for whatever purpose. That's not the purpose of the app.
Joanna's group did a study of period apps called Menstrual Apps, How to Turn Your Period into Money, for others. They found that information users give the apps can be shared with third parties, including social media platforms, marketing agencies, research institutes, employers, and Google Analytics. Flow, the biggest period app in the US, has collected more than 13 billion data points about its users. Flow says the data helps women monitor irregular periods and has helped a lot of its users get pregnant. The app, based out of Minsk in Belarus, got into hot water recently over sharing some user data with Facebook. After an uproar, the company said it was only using Facebook Analytics to improve the user experience and that it would stop. But in China, where the biggest period apps in the world are based, companies have gone much further. Daima, one of the market leaders there, said it crunches its users' data to find out whether to show them ads for tampons or ads for ovulation kits. Still, Joanna's group found that when it comes to privacy policies, not all commercial period apps are created equal. They cited Clue, a Berlin-based period app that's especially popular in Europe, as an example of a clear privacy policy. Clue also lets you store your health tracking data on your phone without sharing it with the company, as long as you do not set up a user account. I wanted to get an industry perspective on this open source backlash against commercial period apps. So I went to visit Clue's CEO, Ida Tin.
I never started this company because I wanted to build a business. I wanted to solve a problem. And so I think there are definitely many nasty ways that you can be commercial in this industry, and that is happening. I do understand their sentiment. I still believe that there must be a different way. I think it's a problem that we have become used to having free digital services, and free in quotation marks, because of course we're then really paying with our private data.
Clue's terms of service allow user data to be shared with academic researchers, and it doesn't explicitly rule out commercial use. However, Ida said she does not want to run targeted ads or sell user data. But Clue has $30 million in capital from investors, and she's wrestling right now with how to turn her period app into a sustainable business. She wouldn't talk about exactly how that might work, except to say that she has three concrete ideas that she's working on right now. Clue has already experimented with a subscription model, charging women about $1 a month for more data analysis. Marie started seriously thinking about period apps after doing a study of Clue. She was working on her master's thesis in sociology in early 2016, and she interviewed 10 women about how they used the app and what they were getting out of it. Some were bisexual, some heterosexual, some wanted to get pregnant, and some did not. they were all getting something different out of the app.
At some point, I had like 9 different period apps on my phone, and I was trying to track and see how different they are.
And that's where we get back to the idea of a black box. Marie had all these different apps on her phone, but she could not see into any of them. She didn't have access to any of the code. Even Clue, with its easy-to-understand privacy policy, didn't let her see what was going on behind the screens.
If we use technology and we think it's useful and we think it makes our life easier, but at the same time, we can't look behind the scenes. We can't understand what is actually happening with the data we generate, what is the code actually about. It became more and more important to me to rely on open source software. And so I was, in a way, like unsatisfied with period apps and with, I think, with health tracking apps in general.
By September 2017, Marie was toying with the idea of writing her own open source period app. She had already linked up with one potential collaborator, a 30-year-old mathematician named Tina Baumann. Marie turned to Twitter to see if anyone else was interested in making it a more serious project. She tweeted in German, something along the lines of, "Who wants to fiddle around with an open source menstrual cycle app with me?" She included a GIF of a little girl with a lot of attitude.
Yeah, it's just a GIF showing a small girl throwing very confidently, giving away 3 tampons, I guess. I just thought in this moment, okay, let's just give it a try and let's see what happens if I tweet about it. And I got quite a few retweets, quite a few likes.
More than a dozen people responded. Among them was Julia Friesel, a 34-year-old software developer. She became the third member of the team and brought the coding experience they needed. But there was one important thing they were still missing: money. In order to work full-time on the period app project, they needed some other way to pay the rent. In early 2018, they got a German government grant called the Prototype Fund. It's designed to promote open source technology and public interest projects.
And it felt like, okay, this is it. We really were super motivated by this fund, and we thought, okay, this is our chance now or never.
Marie and her team already had a list of ways they knew they wanted their period app to be different. Some of them had to do with design, things like no gendered colors, pictures, or text. Some had to do with making the tech open source. And some had to do with how the app itself would work and what kinds of predictions it would make or not make. Beyond the privacy issues, predicting when women might get pregnant is probably the most controversial thing about period apps. Most of the commercial apps you'll find in the App Store will show you a few days or a week when you should be most fertile. Some even give the likelihood of whether you'll get pregnant on a certain day down to the 0.1%, based purely on when your last period started. But everyone's cycle is slightly different, and some irregularity is common. Cycles can last anywhere from 21 days to 40 days. Period apps do not come close to being fail-proof as contraceptives. The Drip team decided they needed to base their app on science. They turned to Petra Frank-Hermann, a gynecologist at Heidelberg University Hospital. Petra is an expert on what's called FAB, or fertility awareness-based methods for determining when women can get pregnant. Recently, she's become interested in period apps.
Since more than 30 years, I'm doing research on the fertile window of the female cycle and on FAB methods. And of course, I'm very interested in apps supporting women in using those methods. And my second motivation is that as a gynecologist, I meet young women and teens, or I met already young women and teens who experienced unplanned pregnancies with those apps, even the daughter of a close friend of mine.
Petra surveyed a dozen apps that were already on the market last year and which claimed to help women choose the best time of the month to have sex in order to get pregnant. She graded them on a 30-point scale based on how they determined the fertile window, what study results existed to back up that method, what study results they had to show the app works, and whether they offer any counseling to users. All the calendar-based apps she reviewed, including Clue and Flow, got 0 out of 30 points. Even Natural Cycles, a Swedish app that asks women to input their resting body temperature or basal body temperature for better accuracy, got only 2 out of 30 points in the survey. Part of the reason Pejka's team graded all the apps so low is that there's not much independent research to show whether they work. The other reason is that when it comes to periods, past performance is no guarantee of what will happen in the future.
Most of the apps do predictions. Even if they use, for example, parameters like the temperature, this is, for example, the app Natural Cycles. It does predictions as well. And in our opinion, therefore, they are useless for contraception.
When you say predictions, do you mean making predictions based on past cycles?
Past predictions on fertile days on the basis of past cycles, yes.
Okay, and that is not going to help you not get pregnant?
Yes.
Or get pregnant?
Yes. Yes, due to the variation of ovulation day and fertile phase, even in women with fairly regular cycles.
I think that's something that a lot of women don't realize.
Yes, yes, that's true. This is the point.
So do you think people should be trusting their family planning to these apps?
No, because most apps are lacking scientific studies or they showed poor results up to now.
Your body can actually tell you more about when you're likely to get pregnant. There's a method that's been around for decades called the symptothermal method. It involves taking your resting body temperature every morning and checking your vaginal secretions to see when the cervical mucus turns clear and stretchy, like raw egg whites. It's a lot more work than ticking off days on a calendar, but it fits the ethos of the DRIP project, which is helping women learn about their own bodies and take control of their own fertility.
I think that's the point, that you can't really predict when ovulation will happen, but you can only like watch your body symptoms to see when it happened. And so you can only be sure after it happened, but like, I don't know, bodies are different. It also depends on your stress level or, I think there are
time zones,
traveling, sleeping. There's so much that can influence ovulation or the time of ovulation.
That was Tina, the mathematician on the DRIP team. Before the team could start work on the project in earnest, something ironic happened. Tina got pregnant.
I was kind of afraid to tell them because I didn't know if this would mean like the end of the project for me. So I was sitting there in the kitchen like, I have to tell you something. And I said like, no, I'm pregnant. And they're like, oh, how cool. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know what this means for the project. And they're like, oh, we'll make it work.
The team finally started work on their app in April of last year. In late June, Tina had her baby. A few weeks after that, they were back to weekly meetings at Tina's apartment, working on the project while she breastfed. But the prototype funding from the German government was only good for about 6 months of work, and the team knew that they would not be able to finish the entire project themselves. They needed the open source part of the app to really come into play. They needed a bigger team of people to help code.
And so we actually organized events, I think 3 at least, where we said, hey, if you're interested in contributing or if you want to see what the project is all about, come meet us and we will set up the project together, because it's a little bit of a pain. And I think sometimes it even took 2 hours from like saying hello to the first person having the app running on their phone. But I think it was like, it's kind of nice to get people over this sometimes painful step, like not sitting at home and you're like, oh, why do I get this error message? And then maybe quitting, but you're sitting there all together, like talking a little bit, but also one person might be already a step ahead and they can tell you like what they did.
The DRIP team won another fellowship from the Mozilla Foundation, and that helped them get the word out about the project. And they joined some programming workshops called Code and Cake. The workshops are run by a group of programmers who use the coding language Ruby on Rails, and they help teach newcomers to code. They found a lot of interest. A designer helped figure out the user interface. Another designer made a logo. It's not pink and girly. And over the course of a few months, they created an app that lets users track ovulation and other symptoms while keeping their personal data private. Along the way, the number of code contributors grew from 3, Marie, Tina, and Julia, to 17. Here are two of the volunteers, Sophia and Maria, a Russian couple who live in Berlin, talking about how they got involved. We were standing outside the Rainbow Cafe during a break in the DRIP launch party.
So, okay, I will reveal the secret. So I'm already working as programmer, and Maria is my wife, and she was really curious about programming. She actually has a degree in programming, but it's
never done it professionally.
Yeah. So we decided to make something real, like to find some project to work on it, and something real that we can potentially also use.
Sophia doesn't even have an Android phone, so she cannot use DRIP herself. But Maria does. She had been using Flow, the Belarusian app that came under fire for sharing data with Facebook.
So switch from this pink and furry Flow and try DRIP out.
For Ida Tin at Clue, the Bloody Health Collective and the DRIP app are a sign of the times. She thinks people are caring more and more about what health apps and the rest of the tech industry do with their data.
When a group of people get together and say, hey, let's just build this, I think that's great. I mean, it's the same that I did, right? And I'm very curious to talk to them because I think we have, you know, very much on the same mission. And I would be very curious also to ask them, like, what is it that you feel that we're doing that doesn't meet your requirements? Why did you feel that there is a need for this?
Ida argues that for lots of users, having their data stored somewhere else than their phones is actually a really good thing. It helps ensure they don't lose years' worth of period tracking data if they lose their phones. It could help researchers use aggregated data from lots of different users to learn more about periods themselves. And finally, because Clue's developers can see how users are interacting with the app, it's a lot easier for them to fix things that go wrong.
And then maybe they have something also to learn from me who have, you know, maybe seen the limitations of what happens when you don't have a backend, when you don't, like, well, maybe they want to do something different. Or I don't know. I haven't spoken to them, but I'd be very curious to.
The backend, all the parts of the app that users don't really see, will be a bigger challenge for Maria and Tina's group. They are dependent on users telling them what's working with the app and what isn't. They cannot see it themselves. And another challenge is that for now, DRIP is only available on GitLab, an open source software forum. It's not in the app stores where most people download new programs for their phones. To make the first female-designed open source period app a success, DRIP first needs a lot more people to start using it, and even more importantly, to give feedback about how to make it better. And Marie and the team will eventually need to focus on other jobs, so they need coders to contribute to it too. One important step in creating that team was the launch party at the Rainbow Factory. The initial response was good. Here's Tam Eastley, a Canadian developer who has lived in Berlin for years.
The first thing that I was really excited about is normally when you download an app, it says this app is going to have access to like your camera, your location, your like this random folder you didn't even know existed. And then you have to agree, otherwise you can't use it. And you're so rarely aware of what you're agreeing to. And you just end up saying, okay, because you want to use it. But with this app, it was like, this app will not have access to anything on your device. And I forget, I assume you had to say okay to this, but I was just like, I've never, ever seen this before in an app. This is so cool.
They will need to find a lot more users like Tam to make DRIP self-sustaining and to ensure that the work they've put into it so far won't be in vain. A few weeks after the launch, Marie told me that about 50 beta testers had downloaded the app, and suggestions for tweaks to the code were pouring in. Marie is optimistic.
It's also about switching the role of this passive user to an active contributor, if you want to see it like that. So being like, do I actually like that? Did I expect something else? And this is kind of the question that everybody can answer.
Next month, the team is planning to add Drip to F-Droid, an app store for free and open source software. They hope that will increase their user base. To Marie, the small community that's developing around the app is its biggest strength. It's also a sign of how people are thinking more and more about not just how the software they use helps, but also what it takes from users and whether that trade-off is worth it.
And that's it for this week's Prognosis. Thanks for listening. Do you have a story about healthcare in the U.S. or around the world? We want to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Faye Cortez or at Naomi Kresge. If you were a fan of this episode, please take a moment to rate and review it. It really helps new listeners find the show. This episode was produced by Lindsay Cradwell. Our story editors were Drew Armstrong and Rick Schein. Francesca Levy is head of Bloomberg Podcasts. We'll be back on April 25th with a new episode.